We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In New York in the late 60s, there weren't many places where gay men and lesbians could go for a night out, have a drink, meet people, dance. And known gay bars and their patrons were frequent targets for police harassment. Then, one night in June of 1969, the anger of the gay community boiled over and they started to fight back. In this hour of Focus, we'll be looking back to the Stonewall Riots, some people prefer to call them the Stonewall Rebellion. In fact, this is the topic of a new documentary, and that's what it's called. It's called Stonewall Uprising. That'll air on the American Experience on many public TV stations, including ours. So you can see this tonight at 8 o'clock on WILL-TV. We'll talk about the event and its significance to the gay rights movement in this hour with historian David Johnson from University of South Florida. He's joining us by phone. And right after the show, Professor Johnson will be taking part in a live chat on our community engagement website, willconnect.org. We'll tell you more about that later. Our guest, David Johnson, teaches on modern U.S. history and particularly the history of the Cold War. He's also an authority on gay and lesbian history. He's joining us this morning by telephone. Questions are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to send us an email, you can do that, will-talk, W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. And Professor Johnson, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it.
Thanks.
There's a lot, you know, we want to talk a little bit about the actual event, but I think it's also important to place it in a kind of a context to talk about the moment in American history that it occurred. And I was really struck watching this documentary, Stonewall Uprising, by a comment that someone makes early on. They say, in reference to Stonewall, they say, this was the Rosa Parks movement. This was the Rosa Parks moment,
right,
for gays. It's very clear that a lot of people felt this was very significant because it was the time when finally an oppressed group stands up and says, we're not going to take this anymore.
Right, right. And this oppressed group, the gays and lesbians, had been watching other groups do this throughout the 50s and 60s, right, watching the civil rights movement and watching it become more radical, watching women finally rebelling. In some ways, they're the last group that does it. This is the very end of the 60s, right? This is the summer of 69.
Mm-hmm.
But it is considered, Stonewall is considered the sort of Rosa Parks moment. It's often considered the beginning of the gay and lesbian rights movement. Of course, it's not. The gay and lesbian rights movement had been ongoing. There had been small gay rights organizations in Los Angeles and New York and other cities, the Mattachine Society. And they had even engaged in picketing public demonstrations in front of the White House and Independence Hall. And like with many of these civil rights milestones, they're often not actually the first one. Even the Rosa Parks example. Rosa Parks was not the first black woman not to refuse to give her seat up on a segregated bus,
mm-hmm,
in the South. There were other women who had done that, but there was something about that moment, the fact that Rosa Parks got the support of the NAACP behind her, and it led to a change in the movement. Similar with Stonewall, there were other times when gay people had demonstrated. There was a small riot in San Francisco in 1966 at a cafeteria frequented by a lot of transgender people, and they confronted the police there. So it wasn't the absolute first confrontation, but it was certainly the biggest moment when gay people stood up and said, we're not taking this anymore.
Mm-hmm.
We're fighting back.
I think also when you think about the moment, it's important to make the point that for most gay people in this country, unless perhaps they had a celebrity status, that being out just was not possible, that in addition to being socially ostracized, you could be physically attacked. People weren't out to their parents. That would have been an issue. People could lose their job. And sex between consenting adults was illegal. So I think when you think about what happened and how people were feeling at the time, mm-hmm. you had to also consider what at the time it would have meant to be gay.
Right. You're absolutely right. You could lose your job. People were routinely arrested just for cruising a known gay cruising area. You could be arrested. It was very difficult for people. But at the same time, we can't condescend and think, well, nobody was openly gay before 1969. People were in their private lives. Openly gay. People were members of gay organizations in the 1960s. Mm-hmm. They were pioneers. They were courageous. But even the fact that people were going and in droves to gay bars was in and of itself sort of an act of defiance. Meeting publicly with other gay people.
Mm-hmm. There, I think one of the points that particularly the piece makes is that if you were gay in America at the time, particularly if you lived in a small town, this would be really difficult. And for that reason and maybe some other reasons, many gay people decided, well, the place to go would be to a big city where hopefully they could meet somebody else and also they could kind of lose themselves in the crowd. So maybe it's not surprising that some of the first organizing by gay groups were in places like Los Angeles, New York City, Washington, D.C. And maybe it's also not surprising, given what was going on in the 60s in New York, that the reason this happened, the place this happened, was New York City. What was the atmosphere like in New York City in the early to mid-1960s?
Yeah, you're right. There's lots of migration of gay men and lesbians to major cities where there are developed subcultures, whether bars, meeting places, and eventually organizations. And that's kind of the irony that people would go to New York because they knew there was a gay subculture there. There had been one since certainly at least the teens and 20s. In places like Greenwich Village, right, which is where the Stonewall Inn was. And so gay men and lesbians go there and they expect a certain freedom. And they enjoyed a certain freedom, and it was getting, seemed to be more and more open in the 60s. They were winning legal rights, the right to publish gay materials. The Supreme Court said these gay publications are not obscene. And yet, in 1969, in New York, the police are beginning a crackdown on gay bars. They did this periodically in New York and other cities, usually around election time. And there was a mayoral election coming up. So there were a series of gay bars, theaters, places on Times Square that were raided in 1969. So it's that kind of combination of this rising tide of the 60s civil rights movement and the sense of increasing freedom and liberation and yet coming up against a police crackdown.
Mm-hmm. Our guest in this hour of focus is David Johnson. He's a professor of history, associate professor of history at University of South Florida and teaches on modern U.S. history, history of the Cold War, gay and lesbian history. He's author of the book The Lavender Scare, The Cold War Persecution of Gays and Lesbians in the Federal Government, published by the University of Chicago Press. And we're talking about the Stonewall Riot. Some people call it the Stonewall Rebellion. It took place in June of 1969 in New York City and is the subject of a new documentary, Stonewall Uprising, that will air on our television station and a lot of public TV stations tonight at 8 as part of the American Experience. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, and you can email will-talk@illinois.edu. It must have been at the time, while there were bars in New York City that were known as gay bars, that also maybe if you were a bar owner, you might not want to attract that kind of clientele because of these periodic crackdowns by the police. And if they came into your place and they found one person, one gay person, they could close down the entire bar. So for that reason, apparently, that a lot of the gay bars in New York City were actually run by organized crime, and Stonewall was one of them.
That's right. Because in New York, under New York State law, having one gay person in a bar would render it disorderly. So most of the bars were mafia owned. Certainly, the Stonewall Inn was. So the thing about the Stonewall Inn, technically, it was a bottle club. It was a private club. You had to go in. You had to pay a fee to get in. It was considered kind of crummy. But the great thing about it was there was dancing at the Stonewall Inn. It was the only bar in New York where you could have same-sex couples dancing. And people could get into the Stonewall Inn who couldn't get in to other bars, sort of street people, transvestites, young kids, really. So it had an incredible mix of people that frequented the Stonewall and really found a certain sense of freedom at the Stonewall. You know, they could drink, they could dance, they could socialize with all kinds of other gay and lesbian people.
So was it actually illegal for same-sex couples to dance in New York?
No, I don't think it was.
I'm just curious about the fact that apparently this was the one gay bar where there was dancing.
Somebody said it was illegal. It was just still considered, you know, kind of out there. Sort of acknowledging that you had, you know, gay and lesbian people there for actually, you know, dancing and same-sex pairs.
It sounds like, from the way people describe it, it sounds like it was a pretty grimy place. But as you say, it was a place to go and be open. And it was a place that even within the gay community, some people who were considered to be a little marginal could also go. That gets back to this question of how important it was for people to have a place where they could go and why that's so important.
And it's interesting that it's a commercial establishment, right? Mm. That is where they could go. And there were other alternatives. There were, you know, I don't know, parks where people could meet, even in the streets in Greenwich Village. But oddly, this offered or seemed to offer a sort of security, you know, behind these walls at the Stonewall until the police raided it. And raids had been pretty routine, but traditionally the raids were earlier in the evening. They were often announced, or the bar owners knew they were coming. They were early in the evening, so they weren't too disruptive. This was at the height of the bar scene. It was around midnight, so it was very disruptive to the patrons. It was in the middle of the summer. It was a hot night. People talk about the fact that Judy Garland had recently died. Her funeral was that weekend. There was just a whole conflation of events that led to this rebellion.
Well, you know, you wonder about that, the conditions. As you say, that this took place, it was midnight. The place was apparently packed. It was very hot. And only, I think, six police officers went in and started arresting people. And the people did not go quietly. And then as they were brought out, there was a crowd outside that apparently grew and grew, and they got madder and madder. And then finally there was this confrontation with the police. You have to wonder why it is that the police decided on this particular night to do this at this time, send this small number of officers in this place that was full of people. Why did they do this?
Well, we don't know, and even though it's interesting that the police man who was ahead of this raid appears in the film, interestingly. Mm-hmm. I think it's Sergeant Pine. I don't know that he explains why they did it. I mean, it has more to do with the fact that it was mafia-owned. They were operating without a license. It was really almost more a conflict between the police and the mafia, but also was becomes one a conflict between the police and the patrons. Normally in a raid, you would if you were in the bar, you would show ID. If you had ID, and you were wearing gender-appropriate behavior, gender-appropriate clothing, sorry,
right, yeah.
You would just be allowed to leave the bar and go. People who were not wearing three articles of clothing appropriate to their gender could be arrested, or people without proper ID. Normally people would just disperse, but this night they didn't disperse. They formed a crowd outside. And people point to this pivotal event when a lesbian who was being arrested and handled very roughly was resisting arrest. And it sort of excited the crowd outside. And they start throwing things at the bar. And the police actually retreat inside the bar. And this had never happened before to police raiding a gay bar. Just one reason why you say they only brought six people. Well, they weren't expecting a rebellion. You know, these are gay people who usually go quietly into the night, right?
It was just the story, and I would certainly recommend that people, if they can, see the film, because it's a remarkable story. The story of what happened is just really stunning. At one point, they talk about the crowd outside ripping out a parking meter and using that as a battering ram to try to break down the door to get in at the police that are inside. And also there's somebody in the documentary who was the police officer talks. There's somebody who was a reporter for the Village Voice who was in there. And I'm not sure which one or the other of them. Somebody says that they were at some point, they were just convinced that they were all going to die. Certainly if the door was broken down and people got in, that they were going to die. As the police officers were there, they had their guns out. Everybody inside was scared. The people outside were just boiling angry. It seems remarkable, in fact, that nobody was killed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does. It came very close to being violent. I think that's true of a lot of events in the 1960s that could have very easily gone more violent. Some of them did, things like Kent State. It came very close to violence. People were upset. They threw pennies at the bar. The police haven't been paid off, right? That's why they're here. They haven't been paid off as they normally would. So let's pay them off. And they threw coins at the police in the bar. Tried to set it on fire at one point.
In this hour of focus, our guest is David Johnson. He's professor of history at University of South Florida. We're talking about Stonewall. Immediately following our conversation here on the air, our guest will be taking part in a live chat about gay rights on our new community engagement website. That's willconnect.org. He'll be joined by the head of the group Equality Illinois and also a gay rights activist who was at Stonewall at the time. So that's following our show this morning. Right now we have a caller and would welcome others. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Here's someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
The film tonight is a documentary, so it'll be hopefully faithful to the facts. In the mid-90s, though, the BBC produced a film called Stonewall, which was a fictionalized account. I was wondering if your guest had seen that film and whether he felt that it captured the atmosphere and whether it got its facts correct, even though it was fiction.
Well, Professor Johnson, are you familiar with that film?
I have seen it. It's been a while. I think it does give the fictionalized account does give a good sense of what it was like inside the bar, for example, the sort of seediness of the bar, the rage of the patrons. And it's important to note, even for this documentary that's airing tonight, a lot of the scenes in the documentary are actually recreated because there's very little visual documentary evidence of the uprising itself. There's a couple of photographs that we have. So even this documentary has had to kind of fictionalize the retelling of the story.
Two themes in the fictionalized film were the role of the drag queens and also the role of the mafia. Could you address that? And I'll hang up at this point.
All right. Thank you. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, like I said, the Stonewall Inn welcomed a lot of marginalized people that other bars did not. So effeminate gay men, street people, and some drag queens. I think the role of drag queens in Stonewall has been a little bit exaggerated. Certainly there seemed to be some transgender people involved. But it was largely a gay male bar, predominantly gay men. A lot of the initial publicity and press stories about the raid, like stories traditionally about, you know, gay pride parades, in a sort of homophobic way, always focus on the most outlandish people in the crowd. They focus on the drag queens. So since the very beginning, there's been a kind of focus on the drag queens who were involved, but certainly were not majority participants.
And that's, I think, it as you say, it goes back to the coverage of the event, and it seems that the news sources, even the Village Voice, which one thinks of as being a very liberal publication, seem to well, in the stories that they wrote, they used the word fag. And it seemed that they treated the people who were involved in a pretty dismissive and disrespectful way. And I think actually the gay community there, they weren't really happy about that. And then they turned up not long afterwards at the offices of The Voice, which I think is actually not very far away from the Stonewall, and threatened to burn down the Village Voice. And I think then the Village Voice got religion there. And somebody, I think, in the documentary actually says that after that they started using the word gay.
Right.
In their story.
I mean, it's a sign of how much has changed since Stonewall, right? I mean, something that we consider to be incredibly, you know, liberal, like the Village Voice, wasn't in 1968-69. We tend to assume that, you know, the left in America in the 60s and the civil rights movement and all those would naturally be accepting of gay people. They weren't. They had to be taught to be tolerant. Gay people who were involved in these other movements on the left and the civil rights movement were not accepted as gay people, even within those organizations, and had to rebel. That was part of the anger that comes out in 1969.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if there's anything more that you'd want to say about the involvement of organized crime, either in Stonewall. As you talked earlier about the fact that it was a mafia bar, and apparently a lot of the gay bars were mafia bars. Anything else you want to say about the involvement of organized crime in this?
No, not particularly.
Okay. Well, it doesn't really seem that they had a particular presence here, other than the fact that this was their place, and that that perhaps part of the motivation for the raid, as you said, had something to do with the police and the mafia. Although it was also true, apparently, that the police certainly knew that this was a mafia place, and that the mafia regularly engaged in payoffs to the police. That didn't prevent the police periodically from raiding it, but the place stayed open.
Right. And there was talk certainly around the time of Stonewall that, you know, gay people need to form their own, open their own bars and community centers. That they were being oppressed not only by the police, you know, but in a sense by the mafia as well. And they do go on to do that. One of the changes that Stonewall does initiate is a whole series of new, more radical gay organizations are formed right after Stonewall, the Gay Liberation Front and the Gay Activist Alliance. And one of the things they do is form open a gay community center, sort of as an alternative to these mafia-controlled bars, so that gay people can control their places of amusement and gathering.
Mm-hmm.
They would hold dances at the gay community center.
And one of the things that happened afterwards, the very next night, there was this determination that the Stonewall would reopen. I'm not sure whose determination that was, whether it was the people that the mafia that ran the place, or whether it was the patrons who wanted to make a point of saying, well, you can try to shut us down, but we're not going to let you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that was the mafia. The Stonewall was a cash cow for them. They made thousands and thousands of dollars every night. It was their own liquor. They obviously put very little money into the building itself. They had charged high prices for drinks, and there was an admission fee. And so, they wanted to reopen.
Yeah, I think that they make the point in the piece that probably the liquor was all stolen to start with, that they were watering it down. The mafia was on both ends of the deal. They were making money.
Right.
This is Focus. I'm David Inge. In this hour, we're talking about Stonewall. Our guest for this program is David Johnson. He's professor of history at the University of South Florida. In a moment, we'll talk some more about Stonewall and what it meant for the gay rights movement. We'll also take a call. First, we have a short break. This is Focus.
Benazir Bhutto, the first woman elected to lead the Muslim nation of Pakistan, was chosen by her father, Pakistan's first democratically elected president, to carry his political mantle. Join us at the next community cinema screening for Bhutto and the post-screening discussion. The film is closed captioned and the discussion will be translated by a sign language interpreter. The free screening, open to the public, is at the Champaign Public Library Tuesday evening, April 26th, from 6:30 to 9.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Owens Funeral Home, located at the corner of Elm and University in the historic Trevette Mansion, across from Westside Park in downtown Champaign. Owens Funeral Home, owned and operated by the Owens family since 1925, invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
This is Focus. I'm David Inge. We're here weekday mornings 10 until noon with 10 different topics every week. Tomorrow morning, we'll talk in the 10 o'clock hour with Patrick Smith. He's an airline pilot. He also writes an air travel column for Salon.com. We'll talk about the air industry from a pilot perspective. On Wednesday at 10 o'clock, then we'll talk about the mortgage crisis, specifically how it affected Illinois. Our guest there is Cedric Herring. He's professor in the Department of Sociology at the University of Chicago. We're here weekday mornings, 10 to noon. You can see our complete schedule on our website. You can also listen to past programs. That's WILL.illinois.edu. In this hour of Focus, the guest is David Johnson. He's professor of history at the University of South Florida, has written about U.S. history since 1945, has written about the Cold War, has written about gay and lesbian history. And we're talking this morning about the Stonewall riots. These took place in June of 1969, were very important for the development of the gay rights movement in the United States. And this is the topic for a documentary, Stonewall Uprising, that will air on our TV station, WILL-TV, tonight at 8, part of the American Experience. Also, right after the program this morning, our guest, David Johnson, will be taking part in a live chat about gay rights on our new community engagement website. That's willconnect.org. We have a caller here who's been patient with us. We'll get to them in Mattoon and line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Everything wasn't as sleazy in New York City back in the 60s and the 70s as it's being depicted. I lived there. I was about 10 blocks from Sheridan Square, where I lived, in Chelsea. And, the Stonewall was a transsexual leather bar, which is an interesting combination. And the thing is that there were people that owned it that may not have been of the highest caliber, but you ran into that all over New York City. There were a lot of gay bars in New York City. Julius's was there in Greenwich Village, still is in Greenwich Village, and been there since the 30s. And on the Upper East Side, you would find gay bars that were the most elegant places in the world. We had to wear a suit to go to it. They were for businessmen. And you had some really the beginning of what then became the discos, when you had like Les Jardins, I can speak of, and there was dancing there. The thing is, you did have payoffs. There was mafia involved. I worked with John Lindsay on his re-election in 69. He had been defeated for the Republican nomination for re-election. And so it was an interesting, you know, campaign later that fall. Interesting thing about John Lindsay is John Lindsay had a twin brother who was gay. And he was kept hidden. And yet at the same time, you know, John Lindsay was, you know, very conciliatory about gay people. And also, you know, there were all types of different bars, and you did have to pay off. But the interesting thing that I came across that is that, you know, I worked in New York in advertising, and a lot was just the theater area and such, and so, you know, lived in Chelsea, very gay community. And there was a situation where a friend of mine was a policeman who was gay, and he had to go in as a backup when that raid happened. And if you don't think that didn't destroy him, the interesting thing was that his father was in the mafia. So, you know, David, please don't make it so raunchy. That's just the way things were in New York City. There's a lot of diverse groups, and the thing is that some of those ladies who went into that bar were as tough as nails.
Mm-hmm. No, you make a good point. Yes, sir. There were lots of different sorts of bars, and that little. The idea that one of the police officers was gay is fascinating, and shows how complicated this.
Well, they now have their own group within the police department.
Sure, sure. But the interesting thing is, yeah, there were all these different bars, and there were more upscale bars and more. But it was the Stonewall, right, where the riot happened, because this was where the more marginalized folks could go. The people who had less to lose, who ended up rioting and, in a sense, sparking this.
Well, but over on West
revolution.
Street, across from the West Side Highway, when it was up, you had all the leather bars, and you had a place called the Circus. I won't even talk to you about what happened in there. You know. It had what they called a back room.
Mm-hmm.
And money, you know, I'm quite sure every bar in New York City paid money to somebody.
Sure.
Well, I appreciate the call, and I appreciate the stories. I certainly wasn't, I didn't think that I was making a pronouncement, or didn't intend to make a pronouncement on the whole gay scene in New York City, only about this one particular place, which I only know of by reading about it and having watched this documentary. So I appreciate the comments of the caller. And the other folks, we have about 15 minutes left. If other folks would like to call in, tell us a story, make a comment, ask a question, that's great. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I want, Professor Johnson, I want to make sure that we talk a little bit about the impact of Stonewall on the gay rights movement. As you said in the first part of the show, there were gay rights groups, and I guess the two major ones would have been the Mattachine Society, which was a gay men's organization, and the Daughters of Bilitis, which was a lesbian organization. And there were chapters of Mattachine in New York City. There was one, I believe, in Washington, D.C. And I guess what's interesting to me, though, is that there, in the way people looked at what happened at Stonewall and the way they thought about what sort of action they wanted to take, or whether they wanted to take direct action like this, there was a big break in how people thought about what they should do, and particularly how confrontational they should be.
That's right. The existing organizations at the time, Mattachine and the Daughters of Bilitis, were beginning to be considered kind of a little old-fashioned. They engaged in what people have called militant respectability. You know, they wanted equal rights, and they were willing to picket, for example, in front of the White House or in front of Independence Hall. But they did so in very orderly fashion. The men dressed in suits and ties, and the women wore dresses. So they were open, and they were demanding equal rights. They were demanding not to be fired from the federal government, not to be drummed out of the military, and so forth. But in a very kind of quiet and peaceful way. And by 1969, a lot of particularly younger gay men and lesbians in New York thought it was time for a different approach, a more radical approach. And after Stonewall, where they found new organizations, Mattachine essentially goes away after Stonewall. And they form a Gay Activist Alliance, the Gay Liberation Front, which considers itself part of this larger leftist movement. Remember, in the 60s, a lot of people thought there was a revolution was happening in the United States, all kinds of levels. People really thought the revolution was at hand. And gay people were kind of caught up in that.
Yeah. I'm really struck by the story about how just a few days after this happened, so this happened on June, Stonewall happened on June 28 and then also on 29, that the Mattachine Society had for years been having a regular demonstration, and they had their demonstration on the 4th of July in Philadelphia, city of brotherly love, and that they did it in a way that apparently they always did it, and they felt that it had to be very orderly, that the women were told they needed to wear dresses. The men wore suits and ties. They carried picket signs. They were very, very quiet. They marched. They handed out leaflets. It would have been and apparently it was very important to them to have that kind of image and strike that kind of tone. And the idea of smashing down a bar door with a parking meter to try to get at some police officers, that was just right out. That just shows you about the difference between how some people at one point thought about it was important to fit in, to have a certain kind of image, and then how some other people in a different place under different circumstances would do something completely different.
Right, and did not just want to fit in to traditional American society, but wanted to change American society. And they weren't a lot of these. Were people from New York came down to Philadelphia for these pickets, and they wanted, they didn't want to wear suits and ties. They wanted to hold hands. They were more part of the counterculture. And so that was, 1969 was the last one of those Reminder Day pickets in Philadelphia. And what replaced it was a commemoration of the Stonewall riots a year after, at the end of June 1970. Is the first essentially gay pride parade. It wasn't called that yet, but it was the Stonewall commemoration parade up to Central Park. And people didn't know how many people were going to show up. Were gay people actually going to come out on the street to a gay parade? But thousands did. And Stonewall is still commemorated the end of June every year, in every city in the United States and many cities around the world. That's what why gay pride celebrations are at the end of June.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it's really remarkable to contrast those two, at least the footage you can see and what they say about the pickets, the Mattachine pickets and on 4th of July, and then a year later on the anniversary of Stonewall, this first march, parade, whatever you want to call it, was much more like the happening of the time. When you looked at who was there and what they looked like and what they were doing, it was a party. It was not a decorous kind of political picket. It was a happening, and the atmosphere was so different and so much more in keeping with other kinds of demonstrations and events, what people were doing when they were turning out at the time.
Right. It was a celebration, and people could be who they were. One of the geniuses of Gay Pride and the Gay Pride Parade is that it represents gay and lesbian people, the LGBT community, in all of its facets. So you can, have a group of, gay plumbers dancing and gay Republicans and, gay Democrats and gay teachers and
gay police officers.
And gay police officers.
We're coming down to the point here. We have about 5-6 minutes left in this hour of focus with David Johnson. He teaches history at University of South Florida. Questions, comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. If you want to send us an email, you can do that. will-talk@illinois.edu. Maybe you can talk a little bit more about right after this, what people were thinking about, what they were talking about in terms of organizing, and when what sort of groups came along that ended up taking the place of say, a group like the Mattachine Society.
Well, there were two. There was the Gay Activist Alliance and the Gay Liberation Front. Part of what we refer to as gay liberation movement. And it's interesting to think about the difference between then and now. Those gay liberation folks that organized right after Stonewall really wanted to change American society, change American institutions. So, for example, they wanted absolutely nothing to do with marriage. They thought marriage was a heterosexist, patriarchal institution, and that gay people could form their own sort of relationships. Now, 40 years later, the right to marriage is at the forefront of the gay movement. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a sign of how radical the movement was right after Stonewall in the late 60s and early 70s.
Yeah. That's something that I think is particularly interesting, that if you look around the world, it seems like gay people who live in Europe, for example, the marriage is just not that important to them because they still think that about marriage. That it says something, I guess, about how it is we feel in this country about marriage, that so many people would say that this is something that they want to do, and other places maybe not so much.
Right. Well, I mean, there are a lot of tangible, practical, legal, financial benefits from marriage that a lot of people in committed relationships or with children, that they need. There's a reason for that. But it is kind of a sign of the oddly conservative nature of American society and even the gay movement within American society, that its focus for the last 10 years has been to be included in the two most oppressive institutions in society: marriage and the military.
This, I guess, I find myself going back to how things just came together. So many things came together in so many ways for this to happen. One thing that's very striking about it was it's not like something that was planned, It just there was a critical mass of people, one place, one time, the right circumstances, the right time in America, maybe the right time in New York City, mm-hmm. that it all just came together in a remarkable way for this thing to happen, and for people to suddenly say that they simply weren't going to be pushed around like that anymore. And maybe that's all, you know, we talked about the fact that to do this raid, they went in at midnight, and this place was full of people, and six police officers went in thinking, well, they could do that. And nobody was going to push back, and that they were very surprised by the pushback that they got.
Right. Well, they were going into a very beloved bar in the center of one of the oldest and most established gay neighborhoods in the country. On a hot summer night in 1969, yeah.
Yeah. And something else that really I think is striking, and it certainly comes through in the documentary, is people talking about, when we're doing our summing up, it's really striking to me how people talk about what happened there and since as being very American. That what people were saying was, you know, you America, you say these things about freedom. Mm-hmm. Let's follow up on the promise. You know, we're expecting that if you make promises that you, America, that you're going to deliver.
That's right. Demonstrating for your rights is in fact a quintessentially American act, and that's what a lot of activists in the 60s said. We want to make America better. Mm-hmm. We want it to fulfill its promise. That's certainly what Students for Democratic Society said in the New Left. We see places where America isn't living up to what it says it's about, freedom and justice and democracy. And we're going to try to make it do that.
How did people in the New Left, at least early on, maybe around the time we're talking about, how did people in the New Left think about gay rights? Was that something that they were comfortable engaging with, or were they not comfortable with that?
No, they were not comfortable at all. They weren't even particularly comfortable with the idea of women's rights. A lot of women who were involved in the New Left kept out of leadership positions, told to make the coffee and run the mimeograph machines. And they turn around and say, wait a minute, you know, how can you, brothers in arms against oppression, you're oppressing us too. And a lot of gay people had a similar experience in the New Left.
Mm-hmm. We talked a little bit earlier about how difficult it would have been to be out and to be gay. Now, your point was certainly there were a lot of people out. There were people out to their friends and their acquaintances, and maybe within a circle they would be out. But it was also the case that to be out could, for example, mean you'd lose your job. And I'm just interested in maybe for a minute or two here connecting to the subject that you wrote about in the Lavender Scare. And people are well aware of communist hunting that went on in the McCarthy period, and we're still talking about this potentially being an issue, maybe not quite as much of an issue at this point. But how did things change for people who worked for the government after this point? Was it easier or more possible to be gay and to be a government employee?
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, it had. Throughout the 50s and much of the 60s, federal government, which was the nation's largest employer, had a policy of excluding anyone really suspected of being gay or lesbian from employment at any level. So not just the military, but any civil service position, government contractor position, and even had a very serious security apparatus designed specifically to find these people and get rid of them. And you know, this is the nation, not only the nation's largest employer, but kind of the model employer. So a lot of private industry followed suit. There are a series of court cases that people came in who were fired from the government bring. And it is, oddly, just about this time, in the late 60s, that they're starting to win these cases. The federal government is fighting back very hard, and even when they are told by the courts that they have to stop discriminating, they're resistant to it. But it is actually about 1969 when this change happened. It's not because of Stonewall, but clearly there's something in the air. There's all these other legal changes that are going on that all kind of culminate at this moment.
Well, there we're going to have to leave it with thanks to our guest, David Johnson. He is associate professor in the Department of History at University of South Florida. If you'd like to, read his book on the subject we were just talking about, it's The Lavender Scare, The Cold War Persecution of Gays and Lesbians in the Federal Government. Now, the conversation here will continue online. Our guest, David Johnson, and a group of panelists will be part of a live chat about gay rights on our new community engagement website. That's willconnect.org. Feel free to head over there right now. And also, if you can, tune in for Stonewall Uprising, part of the American Experience series. Will air on many public television stations, including ours, WYLL-TV, tonight at 8 o'clock. And Professor Johnson, thanks very much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.